Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen indicated to CBS News the Treasury Department does not intend to bail out Silicon Valley Bank. It was used heavily by tech and venture capital companies, but it failed last week. Senate Banking Committee member Mark Warner told ABC's This Week the best outcome is to find a buyer for the bank before markets open in Asia later today.
Shareholders in the bank are going to lose their money. Let's be clear about that. But the depositors can be taken care of, and the best outcome will be an acquisition of SVB.
As of right now, the FDIC says the bank will open as scheduled tomorrow morning. Thousands have had to evacuate their homes in Northern California amid more flooding, especially along the Pajaro River in Monterey County after a levee burst. 50 million people in the U.S. today are under some kind of weather alert. And scientists ran tests in Hawaii and say the second largest volcano there, Kilauea, is not erupting despite 61 days of volcanic activity. This is ABC News. Could be plenty of history at tonight's Oscars. Jimmy Kimmel is the host. ABC's Jason Nathanson has a preview.
I am really good.
Michelle Yeoh might not just be really good, she could make history at tonight's Oscars. If the Everything Everywhere All at Once star wins Best Actress, she'd be the first Asian woman to win in that category. If The Fabelmans composer John Williams wins Best Score, the 91-year-old would be the oldest Oscar winner. Black Panther Wakanda Forever's Ruthie Carter is up for Best Costume Design. If she wins again, she'd be the first black woman with more than one Oscar.
I am queen!
And a win for Wakanda's Angela Bassett for Supporting Actress would make her the first actor from a Marvel movie to win an acting Oscar. Jason Nathanson, ABC News, Hollywood.
Authorities in Mexico said over the weekend they arrested five more people in connection with the kidnapping of four Americans, two of whom were killed. Meanwhile, a Mexican prosecutor said the FBI has not gotten involved in the case of three women missing after they crossed into Mexico last month to sell items at a flea market because those women are Mexican citizens with U.S. residency. Brian Clark, ABC News.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. People in Wisconsin getting federal food assistance have seen the last of their emergency aid from the COVID-19 pandemic. Additional SNAP benefits are helping families in need make the transition. Mike Moen reports.
Wisconsin was one of 32 states still tapping into extra aid. Matt King of Wisconsin's Hunger Task Force Group says going back to pre-pandemic levels will result in dramatic swings in monthly support.
Seniors will see a drop from $281 down to $23. So that's a really significant decrease in money that they have available to buy groceries.
Wisconsin administers SNAP aid through its food share program. King encourages recipients to review their eligibility factors to make sure they're receiving the maximum level of aid. And he says you have up to a year to spend the benefits you receive. That means that stretching those dollars, especially any leftover funds from the pandemic boost, can help in the months ahead. Meanwhile, households continue to grapple with higher grocery costs. Eileen Arianza of the national advocacy group Parents Together says its recent survey shows many families are juggling a lot of expenses.
64% of families are saying that they are having trouble making ends meet right now. And the biggest challenges are paying for things like diapers, formula, paying for utilities, paying for housing.
Arianza says families in need should be more outspoken about what's happening.
These types of benefits that help families, that help kids thrive, this is something that families deserve.
The group says it's especially worried with congressional Republicans floating new work requirements or general cuts to SNAP aid. Democrats are expected to fight these proposals. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Hey everybody, how we doing? I'm Charlie Behrens, inviting you to join me Saturdays and or Sundays at noon. It's a horse apiece, whatever you decide. We're doing the Cripescast, where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest, and it's more fun than a six-pack of Jolly Cut. Okay, the pride of Random Lake, that Jolly Good is. Anyway, it's on your Civic Media station and the Civic Media app. And do me a favor, yeah, tell your folks I says hi. Okay, real good.
The Rick Smith Show.
where working people come to talk.
When we got back from the Working Class Heroes radio tour, one of the things that people asked is, what'd you learn? As you're going through rural America, what'd you find? Found angry people, and angry for cause. But the sad reality is they've been fed decades of outrage candy, and they're angry at the wrong people. They're angry at their neighbors. They're not angry at the very wealthy where they should be. Be sure to tune in live weeknights, 8 to 10 p.m. across the Civic Media Radio Network, and have your voice heard.
Wake up and text. Text and eat. Mm-mm. Text and meet up with a friend you haven't seen in forever.
Hi.
Oh, hey.
Text and complain that they're on their phone the whole time. Text and listen to them complain that you're on your phone the whole time. Text and whatever. But when you get behind the wheel, give your phone to a passenger. Put it in the glove box. Just don't text and drive. Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
News and talk. Up, down, and all around the Fox Valley. This is Civic Media.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media. To learn more, go to our website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
I thank you once again for joining me and my wonderful producer, Calvin, who is here with me in the studios of WAUK Radio in downtown Waukesha for this, our second hour of Morning Cannolis, talking in this session, in this coming segment, and the other segments of this hour about the United States Supreme Court. In our first hour, discussing not only the recent events that have prompted an awful lot of people to look at the Supreme Court and demand, require that it impose upon itself an ethics code that will ensure that the integrity of the court is preserved, some legislative actions to impose that upon the court if the court itself does not act. And then we talked right before the break about these two major decisions having to do with Title 42, asylum seekers, and this rule under the Trump administration that asylum seekers could not enter the country while their applications were pending. That probably going away as a review by the Supreme Court based upon the fact that the expiration of the national emergency is going to happen in May. And so the Biden administration recommending to the Supreme Court that it no longer needs to review that case. The Supreme Court taking that matter off of its docket for oral argument purposes, almost certainly going to dismiss that fairly soon. And also, big news of recent times that as a result of a change in the composition of the North Carolina Supreme Court, this major case coming out of that state, attacking and challenging the decision of the high court, finding that the lines that were drawn by the Republican legislature in that state constituted an unconstitutional gerrymander. That case now having been revisited by the present Republican-sided, if you will, conservative-sided Supreme Court in North Carolina, likely going to reverse that earlier decision, question whether or not the Supreme Court, our United States Supreme Court, is now going to continue to hear that case, or has it too likely been mooted by what will happen soon and a case in controversy no longer existing? Again, the good small aspect of that kind of action, if that is dismissed, is that this fundamentally wrong-headed independent state legislature theory or doctrine, giving it much too much credence, calling it a doctrine, this theory may in fact not be before the justices. We don't have to have them pontificate on the legitimacy of a theory that has none. Beyond that, we've got some other things that have happened just in recent days related to decisions by the Supreme Court not to act and to send things back to the lower courts, which once again they can do. I mentioned previously that the Supreme Court has on its docket right now about 60 cases, and that's pretty much a par for the course. As in past years, they normally issue between 60, sometimes 65, 70 opinions altogether. They have issued a few of those already, and we talked about those last week. But it's also finding among its current docket of those 60 cases some matters that need to be returned, or they're denying applications to have them review new cases. And this week we have events in both of those categories. The United States Supreme Court just recently sending six death row cases back to the Arizona trial courts for reconsideration in light of a recent ruling that we have talked about on this very broadcast involving John Cruz. You may remember Mr. Cruz on death row, challenged his death sentence by the jury because he was not permitted through his attorneys to tell jurors during the course of his trial that if he were given a life sentence as opposed to the death penalty, it would be without parole. In other words, he will stay in prison the rest of his life. And we had jurors after his case who indicated that they felt that the alternatives were not good either. Grant him a life sentence, thinking wrongly, which is what they probably did, that he might be subject to parole, or impose the death sentence. They imposed the death sentence, thinking they did not have this alternative. The Supreme Court says no, 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 based upon an application of a couple of very important precedents in this area. The Arizona court has got to advise the jury of its full panoply, all the sets of options available to it, including telling those jurors that if a defendant like Mr. Cruz is, in fact, given a life sentence, he would never still see the light of day without parole. So the high court just in the last few days vacated the judgments for convicted murderers, and their names are Jonathan Burns, Steve Boggs, Ruben Garza, Fabio Gomez, Stephen Newell, and Stephen Reeves. The case is returned to the Superior Courts in Arizona for consideration of the opinion in Cruz. Now, that could take several different forms, including supplemental briefs, court issuing new rulings on all of those cases. And the question, again, is what will the Arizona courts do in all of those cases? Very similar to what happened to Mr. Cruz. Attorneys for Burns and the others had petitioned to the Supreme Court and saying that this, among other things, this is what the lawyer for Burns wrote. He said, difficult to imagine a state rule that more clearly discriminates against federal law than the one at issue here. It prohibits state post-conviction courts from applying decisions that federal law requires post-conviction courts to apply. He's basically talking about these invocations of some precedent here that once again would require under Cruz and the recent pronouncement of the Supreme Court that yes, indeed, juries need to be told about all of the alternatives available to them in imposing or making a recommendation to the sentencing court. So a very important development based upon recent decision by the Supreme Court in the Cruz matter, sending these cases back, saying, you know what, Arizona courts there, you got to take a look at these other cases, similar, maybe not exactly on par with Mr. Cruz's case, but very similar. Take a look at that in light of what we have said in Mr. Cruz's case. It may well be that the defendants may be entitled to the same kind of relief that Mr. Cruz got by virtue of the directive from the United States Supreme Court. Supreme Court sending cases back, deciding not to review those cases because of its recent ruling in this major death penalty case. And then another case, also just this past week, Monday, very significant, a case likewise in which the Supreme Court said we're not going to get involved, turning back, denying what's called a request for certiorari, which is a fancy legal Latin-type phrase that basically means the writ of certiorari granted whenever the Supreme Court says, yes, we will review a case. They issue a writ of certiorari, which literally means send us this case. Send us the full record from the lower appellate court, sometimes from the state Supreme Court. Tell us what happened here, and we're going to review that. Basically, it is a decision by a majority of the members of the Supreme Court to take a look at what happened. Again, that's what happened in Dobbs and Bruin, these other major cases of this past term. That's what has happened in all of those 60 cases still now pending before the United States Supreme Court. And so just this past Monday, the Supreme Court declined to decide a major case involving the First Amendment, and in particular religion. Significant because in recent times, as you know well, as we have discussed on this very broadcast, the United States Supreme Court has very, very much been inclined to review and examine cases involving First Amendment rights, the Establishment Clause prohibiting the government from establishing religion in America, the Free Exercise Clause, also very, very important in the history of the Supreme Court recently. You may recall well that the Supreme Court last year by a six to three majority, shot down a state prohibition on using public money to attend schools that offer religious instruction. The decision basically meant that the parents in the state of Maine could use a state subsidy to send their children to religious schools. It also last year, again, focusing on religion, sided with a high school football coach. Remember this case? He lost his job after offering prayers at the 50-yard line after games, despite objections from the school district that students felt compelled to take part in those. And again, by a 6-3 majority, just last term, the United States Supreme Court in this major First Amendment religion case ruled that the assistant coach, his name is Joseph Kennedy, his prayers were a private matter and did not amount to the school district's endorsement of Christianity, finding once again the free exercise clause takes primacy there. And in other ways, the Supreme Court recently has not only embraced the notion that religion is not only a significant portion of their jurisprudence, but a lot of the guidance having to do with something called a Lemon Test in 1971, where the court ruled that government policies must have a secular purpose, cannot advance or inhibit religion, cannot excessively entangle church and state. That standard has been around for a very long period of time. That has been more balanced in its application, pretty much abandoned last year in a case involving this Joseph Kennedy and his football involvement, the football coach, pretty much abandoned this longstanding standard in favor of giving due course and due acknowledgement of the First Amendment, but finding that the exercise clause does in fact give these particular petitioners wins in the Supreme Court. So what happened? What happened just this past week that is somewhat, at least on its face, inconsistent with the court's general interest in taking these religion cases and deciding them in favor of free exercise? The Supreme Court declined on Monday to hear arguments in a major dispute between officials in a Florida city who had encouraged residents to attend a prayer vigil, and two atheists, on the other side, claimed that city's involvement violated the First Amendment. How did this come about? Well, officials in Ocala, that's a city located between Orlando and Gainesville, had encouraged residents to attend a 2014 vigil. We have seen a lot of these in America, regrettably, after a series of drive-by shootings that left several children in that community severely injured. So the city says, you know what, residents, you should be encouraged to come, not compelled, but encouraged to come. And the police chief there of Ocala, he was at that point his police chief, signed a letter posted on the department's website and encouraged people to attend. Basically, an invitation of the community to come out to this. The vigil featured police chaplains who were on stage, who were praying and singing in their uniforms. All of that a part of the lower court record coming up. Now, the plaintiffs allege, they charge that the city's involvement in this vigil that included those aspects violated what? The First Amendment, and especially the Establishment Clause. It again says that the government, the Congress, but the government generally, including official entities of government agencies, can't establish or promote or in other ways enhance religion. Long been viewed as barring the government from creating an official religion or favoring one religion over others. And so at issue for the Supreme Court was a procedural question where the plaintiffs who had attended the rally and alleged that they were aggrieved by what they saw were injured in a way that established what? Standing, whether they had the capacity to sue, whether they could claim injury. Right after the break, I'll tell you what happened before the United States Supreme Court just this past week, what they did in this case coming out of Florida. Stay with us for that.
This is Pat Greitlow from Up North News Radio. On the air, online, or on demand, make it a point to catch the first word on Wisconsin news, sports, and more weekday mornings from 6 to 8 all across the stations of the Civic Media Radio Network.
Hey, this is Jim Santel. I am the host of Morning Cannolis. every single Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. We talk about the major stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Delighted to have you join, call in, and be a part of our discussion right here on the networks of Civic Media.
Earl Ingram.
They can't tell you one thing that Ron Johnson has done to support them. I don't understand that. I never will understand it. I know we've got conservative listeners, but I ask them to point to one thing that Ron Johnson has done to make their lives any better. And they can't point to any of it.
Conversations that hit home every day. The Earl Ingram Show. Weekday mornings 8 to 11 on Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
Weather brought to you by you and your great business. For just $150 a week, this sponsorship is designed to make your phones ring.
But the offer absolutely ends March 15th. Log on civicmedia.us/weather. civicmedia.us/weather.
Here's your updated forecast. Cloudy skies expected this afternoon with daytime highs approaching 45. Winds out of the west, 20 to 25 miles per hour. Lows level off around 23. Tonight, overcast skies. Overcast again tomorrow. Snow likely. Highs level off around 26. 2 to 4 inches of snow tomorrow through tomorrow night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley on 98.3 FM and 1100 AM WISS. Right now, 38.
From Oshkosh to Green Bay and points north, wherever you are in the Fox Valley, count on us to keep you connected, informed, and entertained. Civic Media.
Welcome back. We are talking about religion in America and the First Amendment and this significant decision by the United States Supreme Court just this past week not to hear a case involving the establishment of religion, arguably the free exercise of religion, but really an establishment case that was before it on an application for the Supreme Court to include this matter among the 60 or so already decided. This past week, the Supreme Court declines to hear this case, makes this decision without comment from the High Court, with exception of two justices. We'll hear from them in just a moment or so. It basically leaves in place a lower court appeals court ruling that found at least one of the plaintiffs, one of the so-called atheist plaintiffs, did in fact have the right to sue, that they did in fact have standing based upon what they alleged was their being aggrieved by virtue of this event and this vigil in 2014. So it is a departure, if you will, from the Supreme Court's traditional practice in recent times to take these cases and to reaffirm rights to religion, and specifically to overturn, to not enforce the Establishment Clause here, again, the case not decided by the Supreme Court, but saying basically we're not going to overturn the lower court decision that says, yes, indeed, this lawsuit, at least as to one of the plaintiffs, can in fact go ahead. That plaintiff does have standing to sue. They have alleged a sufficient amount of injury or damage to state a cause of action in the lower court. And that is what the Supreme Court ruled just this past week. Now, interestingly, two of the court's conservative justices wrote brief opinions about the decision to decline the case. Significantly, Neil Gorsuch, again, joining in this decision to decline to block that lawsuit, to send this back, nonetheless said, really, most every governmental action probably offends somebody, he said. He agreed with the court's decision, again, not to intervene in this case. So he's with the majority. He was referencing a concurring opinion that he himself had written back in 2019 involving the separation of church and state. He said, no doubt, too, that offense can be sincere, sometimes well taken, even wise, but recourse for disagreement at offense does not lie in federal litigation. Again, Neil Gorsuch joining the majority here is saying, you know what, we shouldn't be deciding this, and in particular, one of the defendants has a right to sue, should be heard in court, and does in fact have a standing to go ahead. Significantly, beyond that, we also know that another justice of the Supreme Court, Justice Thomas, wrote that he had serious doubts, his words,
about the ability of the plaintiffs to file the lawsuit. And again, he did not concur with the majority. He said the courts are empowered to judge the legal rights of litigants in actual controversies, not hurt feelings. And so he would have plainly reversed, if you will, the decision of the lower court to find that there was standing here. Again, not in the majority. The case goes back, if you will, to the lower courts, where this particular plaintiff has a right to pursue his claims that under the First Amendment, his rights, the Establishment Clause, was violated in the organization and the public promotion of this vigil way back in 2014. Fascinating. We'll look at that as that percolates down and up through the lower courts once again, coming out of the state of Florida. The Supreme Court was also busy this week, also reconfirming what it's going to happen in the next few weeks, having to do with arguments. We talked before about the likelihood that it is going to not be scheduling, going to be canceling arguments on the Title 42 case and also other cases that are pending before it, including, of course, matters that it has previously placed on its docket before the Supreme Court. So this past week, however, the Supreme Court did indeed say that it will continue to hear arguments in at least four other cases, and they're scheduled for argument on March 20th, March 21st, March 22nd. And yes, I'm going to pull one on from April 18th because it comes out of the Seventh Circuit in particular. Let me tell you a little bit about those four cases coming up. And once again, what can you do? You can listen to these oral arguments on the days of their argument. If you happen to be in Washington, D.C., yes, the Chief Justice has said that you may show up there and wait in line. And you can actually go in now after the pandemic has waned a bit. The Supreme Court is now open for visitors once again, not for tours of the building, but nonetheless, you can go in and see the Supreme Court in action. And on March 20th, you can go in and see the Supreme Court do this, or if you're still here in Wisconsin, you can tune in to the Supreme Court and listen live to the oral argument in a case called Arizona versus Navajo Nation. You can also hear, of course, the recorded version of that oral argument, as you can hear the oral arguments of any other case that already has been argued. And what is this case all about? Well, it turns out that in 2003, the Navajo Nation had sued the Department of the Interior, bringing claims under the National Environmental Policy Act and a breach of trust claim for the failure of the government to consider the nation's water rights in managing the Colorado River. This is an environmental case, very significant case having to do with the rights under the National Environmental Policy Act, sometimes called NEPA. After reconsidering the breach of trust claim, the district court had dismissed the complaint entirely. The appeals court in the Ninth Circuit had reinstated that. And the question is whether or not, once again, the Navajo Nation has the right to sue under NEPA with respect to its interests in the environmental issues there, and in particular, water rights under the Colorado River. That oral argument coming up on March 20th. Major case. Why? For two reasons. Environmental case, having to do with the Colorado River, which, of course, is much in the news these days. And also a significant matter having to do with our Native American populations. We know there's at least one other case also pending before the Supreme Court involving the Indian Child Welfare Act, also going to be decided presumably in June. That happening again on March 20th, Arizona versus Navajo Nation. Concerning the water rights of the Navajo Nation in this dispute over the Colorado River and whether or not the lower court position on this should stand or be overturned. Other cases also coming up. March 21, another case involving copycat remote controls. Remote controls coming up on March 21. We'll talk about that case in particular right after this break.
Local radio for your community. Civic Media, broadcasting across the state of Wisconsin.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen indicated to CBS News the Treasury Department does not intend to bail out Silicon Valley Bank. It was used heavily by tech and venture capital companies, but it failed last week. Senate Banking Committee member Mark Warner told ABC's This Week the best outcome is to find a buyer for the bank before markets open in Asia later today.
Shareholders in the bank are going to lose their money. Let's be clear about that. But the depositors can be taken care of, and the best outcome will be an acquisition of SVB.
As of right now, the FDIC says the bank will open as scheduled tomorrow morning. Thousands have had to evacuate their homes in Northern California amid more flooding, especially along the Pajaro River in Monterey County after a levee burst. 50 million people in the U.S. today are under some kind of weather alert. And scientists ran tests in Hawaii and say the second largest volcano there, Kilauea, is not erupting despite 61 days of volcanic activity. This is ABC News.
The Ides of March, the day that Caesar was killed, and it's the final day for you to make a killer deal.
March 15th.
That's right, March 15th is your last day to take advantage of our biggest sale. We're slashing prices on our premium sponsorships up to 50%.
Tie your business message and phone number into our hourly weather forecasts and get results. But you must hurry.
This spectacular offer ends March 15th. Log on to civicmedia.us/weather now. That's civicmedia.us/weather.
You've got questions about navigating the healthcare system? Kristen Lyerly helps us find answers and discusses other issues at the intersection of healthcare and politics. Hometown Health, Thursday mornings at 7:30 on Up North News Radio.
I was just curious as to why you called it the Paul Revere Show.
The Paul Revere Show is named this way because the poem that we all know, the famous Ride, the poem was written to rally the troops to fight slavery and fight for democracy. And so I named the show the Paul Revere Show because I thought it was the time to get on the air and talk about democracy.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m., always on the Civic Media app.
Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian.
I'm really trying hard not to go insane from the mind screw that is this situation. Yes. With I was going to say the GAB, but now it's the WEC, which is audited by the LAB, and then it's now screwed up by the GOP, and we're all SOL. Good for us. Congratulations.
Look at all those acronyms. Yeah.
We're the winners.
Tune in for Dueling Tangents every weekday at 2.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Brock.
Pro tip, if you look up a chili recipe and it doesn't have pasta in it, don't think you can just use all of the same ratios, and adding a box of pasta will not just make it into pasta with chili as the sauce.
You added an entire box of pasta?
I did.
Yeah, that's a little much.
That's too much. Mm-hmm. I had no supervision.
Or like a chili hot dish.
Yeah, exactly.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry, weekdays 11 to 2 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app. Earl Ingram.
I mean, for heaven's sakes, anybody who's heard Congresswoman Bobart from Colorado and Marjorie Taylor Greene and others, you just have to ask the question, if I'm a Republican, why would I continue to support that foolishness?
Asking the tough questions, searching for the answers we're all looking for. The Earl Ingram Show. Weekday mornings 8 to 11 on Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
It's 4 a.m. and you're sucking baby snot through a tube because she's congested. If you love her that much, love her enough to make sure she's buckled in the right car seat. Find out more at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
We are back talking in this segment of our second hour here on our morning broadcast about oral arguments coming up for the United States Supreme Court right before the break, talking about this major environmental case also involving the rights of our Native American populations to be understood and to be heard when it comes to their ancestral rights and their current rights under the National Environmental Policy Act. Right before the break, I talked about another case involving, of all things, copycat remote controls. The case is called Arbitron Austria versus Hitronic International. Fairly complicated case. Basically, something under the Lanham Act has to do with intellectual property
and the dispute between some heavy-duty construction equipment and remote controls, and who is responsibility for and the authority for the production and, yes, the marketing of radio remote controls when it comes to a dispute between something called Hetronic International and another company that was using that same intellectual property to produce similar remote controls. Thus, the copycat description of this case has to do with the Lanham Act of 1946. It basically said that that a national system of trademark registration protects the owners of intellectual property if similar marks are used and there's a dilution of a famous mark is likely to occur. Supreme Court determining who is responsible for diminution, if at all, of that trademark, that copyright, if you will, having to do with remote controls both in this country and around the world. A third case also having to do with products. This one being heard on March 22nd. Fascinating name of the case and interesting background. Jack Daniel's Properties, yes, versus VIP Products. Jack Daniel's versus VIP Products, once again involving the Lanham Act and an issue related to intellectual property in particular. What do we know about this case? Well, this group called VIP Products manufactures, yes, that's right, dog toys that resemble a Jack Daniel's Tennessee whiskey bottles. And Jack Daniel's, unhappy about that, sues the company, sues VIP, for brand tarnishment and violating, once again, the trademark law, the Lanham Act, as I just described it. VIP says that the products are simply spoofs of Jack Daniel's products protected under, yes, that's right, the First Amendment. U.S. District Court, the trial court that hears this case about who's got the right, basically, to use the intellectual property, this vision, this incarnation, if you will, the Tennessee whiskey bottles produced by Jack Daniel's. The district court found in VIP's favor and says, no, this is just a spoof. No violation of the law here. A Ninth Circuit affirms the district court, and Jack Daniel's takes us up to the United States Supreme Court. And again, going to be hearing argument in just a little while here on March 22nd, a little more than a week from now, on who is right, Jack Daniel's or the company VIP Products producing dog toys that spoof the Jack Daniel's Tennessee whiskey bottles. Those are the kinds of things the Supreme Court taking up. Again, important not just for those two parties, but also like the case involving the copycat remote controls. Big deal when it comes to intellectual property, lots and lots of money, and lots of interest related to the copyright, the intellectual property rights of parties in the United States of America, companies and individuals as well. And finally, I want to highlight one more coming up in April, not soon, about a month from now, a little more than a month from now. This is United States versus Super Value. And again, yes, that's right. This is a case involving grocery stores and false statements. It is one of the two cases that are before the Supreme Court in coming out of our circuit, the Seventh Circuit. And the other one has to do with the capacity to sue under Medicare, a challenge basically to the very core of Medicare, as we have talked before. So what is this case about? There are actually two cases consolidated all together, both cases involving the False Claims Act that prohibits anybody from knowingly presenting false claims or making false statements to the federal government. Basically, a concept that goes back way back to the Lincoln administration. Justices asked to determine to what extent a defendant's knowledge, understanding, or beliefs about its conduct are relevant to whether it knowingly violated the law. How does this come about? Yes, Super Value and Safeway. Yes, that's right, the grocery stores, these nationwide grocery chains, operate pharmacies within some of their stores, as you well know. Both are accused of knowingly making fraudulent claims to the federal government for reimbursement under Medicare and Medicaid. How did they allegedly do that? Well, they allegedly reported retail prices for their prescription drugs and did not account for their discount programs. In other words, false statements about their retail prices and the monies that they're getting under Medicare, Medicaid. False statements, affirmative litigation by the government against them to try to recoup monies for statements that they allegedly made. that were in violation again of the False Claims Act. The Seventh Circuit, our circuit, located in Chicago, Illinois, determined that SuperValu and Safeway had not violated the False Claims Act, that the government, the United States Department of Justice, was wrong on this, and the term knowingly in the False Claims Act does not indicate that the term knowingly has some different meaning than its so-called common law definition, the kinds of things you think about routinely when we think about somebody knowing about their violation of law. So SuperValu and Safeway did not violate the act, according to our Seventh Circuit. Supreme Court will tell us whether or not that is the case. An appeal brought to the Supreme Court by your government, by the United States Department of Justice, saying, no, it is important to enforce the False Claims Act. We think that these two nationwide grocery stores did in fact violate the law. We'll look forward to hearing what the Supreme Court says on all of that again in June, maybe July, maybe even sooner, maybe May of this year. Fascinating cases again for many, many reasons. Finally, as we go into our last portions of our Saturday morning program, I promised that we would talk about a couple of major cases, not recent, not current in the way that some of these other matters are current, but nonetheless have impacted our lives as Americans. And I promise to talk today about the Voting Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that has taken some major hits, some major significant hits by virtue of Supreme Court justices deciding that various provisions of it are no longer active, no longer applicable, or at least should be rolled back in terms of the definitions by which they can be enforced. We know that the Constitution of the United States, 15th Amendment, guarantees the right to vote by all people on account of and cannot be denied on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude, one of the post-Civil Rights Amendments. 19th Amendment, 1920, gives women the right to vote. 24th Amendment, prohibition on poll taxes. That happened in 1964. We still had to change the Constitution as late as 1964 to prohibit poll taxes, requiring people to pay money to vote. And in 1971, 18-year-olds, of course, also given the right to vote under the 26th Amendment. 1965, in the midst of all that, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, signed into law finally by President Lyndon Johnson, passed previously by the United States Congress. What does Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act do? It prohibits state and local governments from establishing any voting law that discriminates against racial or language minorities. That's its basic prohibition. We know that well. We also know that this Section 2 outlaws specific mechanisms like literacy devices. In other words, you can't test somebody about whether or not they're literate as a predicate, as a condition for their voting. That also prohibited by the law. And how is it enforced? It's enforced by the U.S. Department of Justice. That's been the way it has been since 1965. There are also a couple of other provisions of the Voting Rights Act. Sections 4 and 5, fascinating sections imposed in 1965. These applicable only to those identified jurisdictions, mostly but not exclusively in the South, that have had this historical record of discrimination in voting based on race, color, or language. And they're identified in the Voting Rights Act as historically violating the rights to vote based upon race, color, or language. And it mandates that if any of those jurisdictions want to change their voting rules and laws, and they need to get approval by the U.S. Department of Justice and the Civil Rights Division in particular before they go ahead and do that, a thing called preclearance. Before you can implement something new, you got to go to the Attorney General and his staff and get authorization if you are in a jurisdiction that has had a history of violating fundamental rights under the Constitution and under the Voting Rights Act. Again, a Voting Rights Act, far-reaching, one of the most effective pieces of civil rights legislation in our history. Amended a number of times, reinforced a number of times by presidents, a number of times the Supreme Court in 1966, 1976, 1986, 96, and 2006 routinely has re-upped the legitimacy of that language, especially under Sections 4 and 5, until a place called Shelby County in the middle of Alabama. Among those pre-clearance jurisdictions, Shelby County says, you know what? We don't like living under the thumb of the U.S. Department of Justice. We think that those provisions, Section 4 and 5, that require us to get permission from the Attorney General before we change our laws, We think that that's unconstitutional. We think at a minimum, the world has changed enough that no longer should we be under that obligation. And they appeal. They appeal not only to the local district court and the appellate court, and those courts both find that the coverage formula under Section 4 and 5 are proper. They basically uphold the Voting Rights Act and say, no, Shelby County, you still got to follow the law. You got to do what the Voting Rights Act in 1965 said you've got to do. We disagree with your view that times have changed. Gets to the United States Supreme Court. And in 2013, on June 25th, 2013, in a case called Shelby County versus Eric Holder. Yes, my boss during the time that I and many others were U.S. attorneys around the country. By a vote of 5-4, the Supreme Court, a case written by John Roberts, finds that Section 4 in combination with Section 5 is unconstitutional because the coverage formula is based on, as Supreme Court Justice John Roberts says, it's based on a 40-year-old fax situation, that they have no logical relationship to the present day. We're beyond that, in other words, is what the Chief Justice says. Goes on to say the 15th Amendment is not designed to punish for the past. Its purpose is to ensure a better future. No one can fairly say, John Roberts says, that the record of recent voting out of Shelby County and in other places around the country shows anything approaching the pervasive, flagrant, widespread, and rampant discrimination that faced Congress in 1965. The Section 4 and 5 in tandem ruled unconstitutional. All of these jurisdictions no longer required under the Voting Rights Act to get pre-approval for changes in their laws. And that remains the carve-out of the Voting Rights Act to this day. Not surprisingly, Associate Justice Ginsburg, joined by Breyer at the time on the court, Sotomayor and Kagan, violently, orally, and also in writing, disagree with that. They say the Congress had sufficient evidence before it to determine the coverage formula remains responsive to current needs. And one of my favorite quotes from Justice Ginsburg, she says this: while discrimination has decreased in these covered jurisdictions, admittedly, including Shelby County, likely attributable to the act itself. It's the very act that accomplishes this. Throwing out preclearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet. Isn't that wonderful language? Again, dissenting from the majority opinion, carving out and ruling unconstitutional this major years-long, decades-long provision of the Voting Rights Act. Ruth Bader Ginsburg coming to the fore and saying, nope, it's like throwing out your umbrella because you're no longer getting wet in a rainstorm. That significant case, Shelby County versus Eric Holder, remains good law. We're going to talk about how you address that in just a moment. But there's a second case. This one's called Brnovich. Likewise, a major case in the jurisprudence of the United States Supreme Court has to do with the application of Section 2. This threshold application, and it comes out of Arizona. And absent any preclearance obligation, Arizona previously under the thumb by virtue of its pre-Shelby County position, Arizona passes two laws that change statewide voting practices. Right after the break, we're going to talk about what those are, how those get to the Supreme Court, and how the Supreme Court, once again, in this major case, limits the impact of our Voting Rights Act of 1965.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
My former boss, George Stanley, former editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I've told you the story of that my brother and I are fighting over who's going to get our tickets. I think I have claim because I live here.
Exactly.
Right? He's older, but I live here.
Yeah, but that trumps it.
So. It's been decided now. It's done.
I'll tell my parents. That's even more.
You can let him go to one game if he wants.
Yeah, exactly.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 11 to 2 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
I'm looking at the phone lines. I'm seeing some familiar faces. Once in a minute, Gina Beauclair.
Well, welcome back, Mr.
mad. I really miss him. We've been missing getting woke every morning, but now we'll get woke in the afternoon.
What's your mind to Andrew of Detroit?
Professor, it's so nice you're back. We missed you during your vacation, and I'm very happy to be in your class for the semester.
Thanks a lot for calling in. I appreciate all my callers.
Tune in to Matt Flynn Direct, Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m.
I grew up hearing that women are bad with money, but I pay bills and take care of my family, so I'm pretty good with money. And now I'm taking control of my financial future by saving for retirement. Jumpstart your retirement savings at WeSaySaveIt.org. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Weather on this snowy, snowy day could be brought to us by your business. Can you imagine how many snowblowers, snow shovels, and snowmobiles are being sold as we speak? Weather sponsorships make the phone ring. Call us at 608-819-8255.
Here's your updated forecast. Cloudy skies expected this afternoon with daytime highs approaching 45. Winds out of the west, 20 to 25 miles per hour. Lows level off around 23. Tonight, overcast skies. Overcast again tomorrow. Snow likely. Highs level off around 26. 2 to 4 inches of snow tomorrow through tomorrow night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley on 98.3 FM and 1100 AM WISS. Right now, 38.
Hey, Fox Valley, if you've got a favorite supper club, we're your station, Civic Media.
We are in our last segment talking about the United States Supreme Court, in particular the Voting Rights Act, and these two major cases that our present Supreme Court and a past Supreme Court, the justices finding that major portions of the Voting Rights Act in Shelby County unconstitutional, basically permitting historically violative areas of our nation to go ahead and change its rules in a way that the Department of Justice can no longer affect. That the case in Shelby County versus Holder, and then the second case coming out of Arizona way back not so long ago, just a couple of years ago, having to do with the application of Section 2. And Arizona passes two statewide voting practices. One, a first one makes it a crime for virtually anyone to collect an early ballot from another voter for delivery to a polling or counting places. Sometimes called harvesting, a phrase that I do not like, because it suggests that something bad is going on, especially in Arizona, where you've got people in very remote areas, including on Native American reservations, who cannot get their ballots to places for collection, therefore picked up by other people. No suggestion there's voting fraud, but simply the transfer of votes from one area to another by a person, not the voter, or not a member of that person's immediate family. That's a crime, to collect an early ballot from another voter for delivery to a polling or a counting place. That's one of the laws. The second one invalidates any ballot submitted by a voter who erroneously, in error, votes in a precinct other than that to which he or she is assigned. In other words, I go to the wrong place and I vote, presumably provisionally. No good in Arizona. Cannot be resurrected. Invalidates that ballot, again, shutting down the legitimacy of that vote. And both of those are challenged under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, this seminal part of the Voting Rights Act that prohibits this kind of discriminatory conduct that limits the franchise. Case goes up to the United States Supreme Court, and again in July of 2021, less than 2 years ago, a case called Mark Brnovich. Brnovich, who is the Attorney General of the state of Arizona, versus the Democratic National Committee, the case known as Brnovich versus DNC. By a 63 vote, the Supreme Court finds that Arizona's out-of-precinct policy and its ballot collection prohibition, these two laws, do not, in fact, violate Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, not enacted for the purpose of promoting any racially discriminatory purpose. The strength of the state interests, again, this written by Justice Sam Alito, who is also the author of the recent decision in Dobbs. He says this: the strength of the state interests, such as the strong and entirely legitimate state interest in preventing election fraud, which, by the way, doesn't exist, served by a challenged voting rule, is an important factor in determining whether the law is legitimate. Identifies fraud as a reason for these two pieces of legislation, and basically limits the capacity not restricted entirely, but limits the capacity under the standards that he sets forth of the Department of Justice to litigate even under Section 2. We know Section 4, basically Section 4 and 5, no longer accessible. Now Section 2, this fundamental opportunity for the Department of Justice to enforce the law, also restricted in this Brnovich versus DNC case. Once again, we get justices of the Supreme Court, Kagan, Breyer, Sotomayor, vehemently objecting. And Justice Kagan in particular is saying, if a single statute represents the best of America, it is the Voting Rights Act. It marries two great ideals, democracy and racial equality, and indeed it does. She says, what is tragic here is that the court has yet again rewritten in order to weaken a statute that stands as a monument to America's greatest and protects against its basest impulses. What is tragic is that the court has damaged a statute designed to bring about the end of discrimination in voting. That remains the law to this day. Shelby County and Brnovich, the one affecting Section 4 and 5, the other is Section 2. What is the remedy? What do we do about that? Well, the answer is, of course, legislation. As I mentioned earlier, we've talked about this a lot on this program. The United States Congress can, in fact, enact laws that basically trump, if you will, that rescind Supreme Court decisions. And indeed, there has been legislation introduced in recent years to do just that. Shelby County versus Eric Holder. Legislation introduced by members of Congress that would do this. Preclearance by the Justice Department for changes in voting laws if, during the previous 25 years, the particular jurisdiction had 15 or more violations of fundamental rights. In other words, limiting somewhat the scope of the preclearance provision, but nonetheless returning it to a position where the Department of Justice can, in fact, approve or not approve the new rules of violating jurisdictions. And again, so the opportunity also for jurisdictions to be removed from the prior approval obligation if they have no offenses for 10 years. That's a solution. That's a fix to Shelby County. Likewise, Brnovich versus DNC, some clear practical standards for violations contrary to what Justice Alito has said, including evidence of disparate impact on voting minorities, coupled with some examinations of the entire system of voting. The elimination of fraud without proof, which is exactly what Justice Alito is advancing, and other available means justifications, that legislation proposed in recent Congresses. How do we know that? The Voting Rights Amendment Act of 2014, the Voting Rights Amendment Advancement Act of 2019, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act of 2021, all of that, and more recent legislation accomplishing fixes of Shelby County, eviscerating again Section 4 and Section 5, accomplishing a fix of Brnovich to return to Americans and all of us the capacity of the Department of Justice to ensure that voting around the country is enforced. Those are the things that the Congress can do right now, passing legislation in the House and then also in the Senate. And this president, President Biden, would sign that legislation tomorrow if, in fact, you advocate for that change, if our representatives in Congress fix what the Supreme Court has done to eviscerate, to undermine the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Do that. Get out there. Advocate for that as we, again, not only here in Wisconsin, but around the country, look forward to more elections in the weeks, the months, and certainly the years ahead. The Voting Rights Act, critical to the future of our nation. Finally, a very significant programming note, and that is next Saturday, coming to you from Mazomanie, the Wisconsin Heights High School in particular, all of us from Civic Media are going to be there. The Wisconsin Grassroots Network is going to be convening at the high school there to talk about very important things related to our lives here in Wisconsin and throughout the United States of America generally. I'm going to be there from 9 to 11 talking about, again, the major issues in America, including something that happened just this past week, the involvement of the U.S. Department of Justice back in Louisville, Kentucky, responding to the situation there having to do with police misconduct in the wake of the Breonna Taylor shooting and horrific murder in that case. Join us next week once again, Saturday, March 19th, for that special program coming from Mazomanie, the Wisconsin Grassroots Network, here on the network of Civic Media. Thank you so much for joining me this morning, and have a wonderful week, everybody. Take care.
March 15th.
March 15th.
What's March 15th?
March 15th is the absolute final day to take advantage of up to 50% off on our Civic Media premium weather sponsorships. First, we spread your business message and phone number to our listeners. Then we spread Mother Nature's plans for the next 36 hours. You'll get a 15-second ad every hour followed by your phone number. Don't wait. March 15th is almost here. Log on to civicmedia.us/weather now. That's civicmedia.us/weather.
Up North News Radio is Wisconsin's new choice for progressive talk about important state issues. From the team that brings you the news through social media, newsletters, and here on the radio.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250